You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
Today's podcast is with Robert Wolcott and Kaihan Krippendorf. This is a cool conversation. Robert is the co-founder and chair of World Innovation Network. He's an adjunct professor of innovation at the Booth School of Business and an adjunct professor of executive education at the Kellogg School of Management. Kaihan Krippendorf is the CEO of Outthinker Networks, a global think tank comprised of corporate strategists, innovators, and entrepreneurs shaping the future of business. So they've co-authored this new book, which is called Proximity: How Coming Breakthroughs in Just-in-Time Transform Business, Society, and Daily Life. We talk about AI, we talk about robots, we talk about healthcare. It's a lot about the future, and it can be a bit scary, but it doesn't need to be. And I really enjoyed where this conversation went, so enjoy the pod.
Another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Robert and Kaihan, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Kelly. This is great.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Thanks. I don't know how much you know about Second City and how we develop our shows, but we use improvisation to co-create our material with our audience. So it's like a 10 to 12 weeks process. We have that sort of two acts that's generally kind of scripted. That third act is completely improvised. That's where we're testing out material, then putting it in the scripted part of the show. And there's a tightrope wire that we're walking when we do this, because you have to wade through a fair amount of failure to get that perfect blend of behavior, context, and comedy that causes an entire audience to laugh at the same time. And as I'm reading your book, Proximity, I'm seeing a lot in common with this future you describe, of which you note that, quote, Alexa's awkward attentiveness is a harbinger. This is exciting, but a bit scary. Do you see that connection when I talk about what we're doing and what you're talking about?
Absolutely. I'll point out, when we were setting up for this, Kelly, Kaihan made the comment, let me turn off my AI note taker before we start.
Yeah.
So this thing is already following us around. You've got it on your wrist. You've got it in your kitchen. Thankfully, we told our kids, we don't leave Alexa in the bedroom. my wife wouldn't like to find out that I had Alexa in the bedroom either, but that's another issue.
Yeah, and I think
go ahead.
No, I've taken a Second City class and some improv classes as well, and I was thinking that until AI, interacting with your device was a little bit like trying to do improv with someone else reading a script, right?
Yeah,
you ask them a question and then they look down the script, they respond. Now AI actually can react to your prompt and respond. So then we see that embedded in all kinds of other things, and I think that we move to a more improvised experience with everything around us.
So I started my career as a producer here at Second City. Well, I started my career as a dishwasher in 1988, but I became a producer in 1992, and Stephen Colbert was in my cast for a couple of years there. And he was the one who wanted to try out this new thing called the internet to get suggestions from the audience. So imagine this in 1993, where we had to get a couple extension cords, and we roll out the computer, the giant computer. We have the AOL dial-up to get the suggestion of dildo from someone that took like 10 minutes to get
right. It's always
not always great for dildo. Comedy. Yeah. And it's also always dildo. So, but this is, you talk about this in the book of like this kind of lag time, this thing that we're in is not unusual. This is kind of how all sort of development technologies work.
Yeah, there are always learning curves for any new technology. And what we tend to do is we see the new thing and we say, what can I do with this to be a little better at what I already do? And that's a good exercise, but that's not enough. What people have to recognize in any field is that technologies that are arising today allow us to do things we could never have done before. And that's where the pivots come.
Yes.
All right. The book's called Proximity. So this is a thing. I was sort of, as I started to read this book, I was like, okay, why is it called Proximity? And you say in the first chapter, quote, people want what they want where and when they want it. Those who can give it to them are more likely to win. That seems like the simplest explanation. I imagine that's why you put it in there. Kaihan, did you guys debate about the title of this thing or did it come to you right away?
No, the whole book was built around the title. This is a term that Rob kind of started developing many years, not unlike maybe you would develop an act, right? He tried the word and it just clicked for people. And we did a summit when COVID hit and we got thought leaders from all over the world to do this 24 speaker summit. And Rob used the term proximity, and it was the number one most mentioned word in the chat from all the other speakers. And so it was built, the whole concept was built around the word.
Yeah, and Kaihan, I think that's when you and I really started talking about working on this book together.
That's right.
It's funny, I was actually on the campus at Northwestern this week. I did for Kellogg a couple of interactive keynotes. And we were doing a storytelling exercise. It's called 60-30-10. And we have you speak of an accomplishment that you have done in 60 seconds. And then we had the person that they were speaking it to repeat it back to them in 30 seconds. And then we had the original person say it in 10 seconds. It's this idea of sort of this ruthless editing to get to the point. And I made the point to the group that I had a playwriting teacher, Louise Mason, who said to me, if you can't tell me what your play is in one sentence, you don't have a play. And I think this brevity idea and this idea of how can you get it down is also an element of this proximate idea.
Yeah, I think it sort of clarifies for people, again, like linking it back to improv, you know, like you think something's going to happen and then someone else responds and all of a sudden you're not in a dining table, at a dining table, you are on Mars, right? And you're disoriented. And I think that today people are thinking AI, 3D printing, global political confusion, digital interfaces, digitization of products, and they're confused. And proximity kind of says, this is the experience when we share this with audiences, proximity says, aha, oh, we're at the dining table. And now I know what to do. It explains all those things and brings it into one picture.
Yeah, it tells us where every industry is going in the long run, but also in the short run. I'll give you an example. Just a few days ago, Apple, you might have noticed, announced that they're going to be installing ELMs, efficient language models, into their devices all over the world. Now, that's related, of course, to a large language model, and large language models sit on massive server farms in Iceland, and they whir away in the cloud. And Apple said correctly, you know what, we need to compress that capability to the extent we can into smaller packages and put them on devices all over the world. And in some cases, they'll even operate without a connection to the cloud. So they call that an efficient language model. In the book, which the manuscript was finished in January, in the book, we talk about LLMs, but we also talk about SLMs, small language models. And Kelly, take a guess what the difference is between an efficient language model and a small language model. Any guess?
Efficient and small feel like they should be the same thing, but they're
well,
not.
Well, guess what, Kelly? They are. It's just Apple Computer, right. As you might know, likes their own name.
Oh, it's their own brand.
Yes. But you see, what the point that we're making here is that all of these digital things can be compressed into smaller and smaller packages and distributed all over the place. And that's what drives the proximity dynamic, pushing production and provision of value ever closer to the moment of demand. So you can now predict things like that. as we did with this book, with respect to small language models, that was already going on. Other people are doing great work. And now here, Apple is driving it forward.
All right. So the difference between a large language model and a small language model is portability?
Well, effectively, the difference technically is the number of parameters. It's very technical, but the number of parameters it's using to do what it's doing. And the small language model, Apple is saying, we can compress it small enough that you can actually operate some of it on the mobile device in the not distant future.
Okay.
As opposed to having to rely on, ChatGPT-4 mm-hmm. is sitting on massive servers in the cloud, and you really aren't going to put that, at least in the near term, you're not going to put that on your mobile device. But this will continue to get smaller and smaller and smaller. And this is true for digital things. It's true for physical products, for food, as you read in the book.
Mm-hmm. Factories get smaller and smaller and smaller. We can put them closer to where they're needed. Amazon can put distribution centers closer and closer and closer to where demand is. And so the value gets produced and delivered closer to where and when it's needed.
Which then is a virtue with regard to sustainability, right?
It could be.
It should be.
Yes. And as Kion just said, it should be. We all know the example of Temu and Shein or Shine, or I don't know how to say it. Does anybody know how to say it? Anyway, it's definitely proximity of provision to go online, buy a piece of fast fashion, and then days later it shows up, from a factory in China. But it's also on a Boeing 777 cargo jet. Now, talk about not great for the environment. They're driving mm-hmm. proximity, but they're doing it with old tools. Whereas what we're proposing is you can increasingly do it with the new tools that allow you to wait, to procrastinate, and then create that one garment closer to demand, radically decreasing waste and carbon emissions.
I thought one of the examples that was really interesting is you talk about this U.S. Army doctor, Colonel Jeffrey Ling, and the idea of on-demand pharmaceuticals. This is a radical idea.
It is.
Yeah, well, Dr. Ling is a radical guy. Go online and find out about it. He's crazy, but he's brilliant crazy. I suppose I should say he's brilliant crazy.
Right.
He is one of my heroes. Six tours of duty in the Middle East. He's in the field hospitals, and they keep running out of generic drugs. And everybody else is trying to figure out supply chains. And the Army, Kelly, will fly the drugs in an F-16 from Germany to Afghanistan to solve the problem. Now, they solved the problem, but none of us can do that. So he said, this is ridiculous. Generic drugs are made of carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen. If I had the right equipment, I could make the drugs here myself. And so he went back to the United States, got a grant from DARPA, worked with a team from MIT, which, by the way, also is the team that helped Coca-Cola build the Freestyle machine. So when you're getting your soda
example.
At Fuddruckers, it's the same technology, a little more advanced. And mm-hmm. today they can do it. On-demand pharmaceuticals can create from basic ingredients almost any generic drug you want on demand. And it's the size of a refrigerator. And it sits there doing nothing until you need ciprofloxacin or until you need atropine or whatever it happens to be. The FDA has confirmed that the drugs that come out of this machine are exactly the same as you get at the pharmacy. And so it's a revolution in healthcare, but also in sustainability, because drugs have shelf lives. We throw out drugs all the time.
Yeah,
they pass their shelf life. But in this equipment, you've got APIs, but set that aside for the story. You've got carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen. What's the shelf life of carbon? Forever.
Yeah.
Yep. I want to pull out one word that Rob used. He used elements intentionally. He actually means elements, carbon. He doesn't even mean molecules. So how do those molecules normally make it into a drug is, they get produced somehow in a vat, and then they get combined and they get processed, and then that gets shipped and packaged, and it takes, but we cut through all of that by taking the basic elements and creating it right then and there.
Yeah.
That's proximity.
So just to be clear, for any of your pharmacologists who are listening, there are some APIs there, so that's not actually just carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, but that's the basic idea.
Yeah.
So like many things, right? The military does these things, which means in how many years this is coming to us? This is suddenly on the corner in our neighborhood, right?
Well, if you live in Tupelo, Mississippi, Kelly, it already is. The first commercial application of it, and this was announced just as we were finishing the book, is in Tupelo, Mississippi. It's limited to 6 injectables because, of course, this is healthcare. We've got to take it slowly and protect people. But since the equipment was switched on in January, this very underserved, very low-income community health system that had stockouts, shortages of these 6 injectable drugs forever, chronically, have had 0 stockouts because of this system.
Oh, that's unbelievable. Okay, so I get brought in to talk a lot at Future of Work conferences. And part of the reason I talk at these things is that people wonder, well, you know, where are we going in the future of work when AI can do all these jobs? And my position on this is like, wow, well, that's awesome, because it's going to mean that our humans need to provide the most human things they have: storytelling, problem solving, relatability, connectedness. And of course, improvisation is all practice in the, it is essentially practice in divergent thinking. You know, where you have no script, right? Like, how do you get good at when there is no script? And there is no script necessarily for the future. So I wonder do you see that there's a world for poets in the world of AI?
I think history tells us yes. I mean, always the pattern is a new technology is introduced and people say no, it's going to ruin everything, and then we adapt with it and we incorporate it in. I can't remember the name of the person, but when the Gutenberg press was introduced, there was a priest, I believe, who said no, we need to protect the scribes,
yeah,
right, because they're going to run out of work. So he wrote a book about it, but it would take too long to write enough copies of that book.
Name was Jimmy Hoffa, Kaihan.
Oh yes, that's it. So he used a press to print it, right? So I think and what has the press done for humanity and for work? And it has opened up things. So I think it's going to open up things for us.
What do you think? The idea of gamification in training is something I'm also intrigued by. We have an expertise in games at Second City, and it seems to me that you have entire generations growing up where they understand games in a really powerful way. And doesn't that seem like that's going to be a more efficient training model for future generations?
I think it makes a lot of sense. I've got 3 teenagers and they play games a lot. And in their world, I could imagine them in the future not having 5 levels. I'm a analyst, I'm a manager, I'm a VP, I'm an EVP, I'm an SVP, right? They're going to have like hundreds of levels. They want 700 levels, and then they can get a promotion every day, right? And that shows engagement. If we look at, you know, games, when they switched from, we're going to produce a new up, I think it's a good example. So it used to be every year you would get a new version of the game, FIFA, whatever, yep, right? But what EA discovered is a better way to engage gamers is, instead of creating new versions of the game, is create new levels and new prizes. And so you're constantly getting the feedback of progress, yeah, right? And what also enables that is proximity, because we're not delivering the game on a CD that gets shipped and you buy from GameStop. We're getting it delivered real time on demand. So it allows us to break things down into small pieces. I think you also now see jobs. We shouldn't have roles anymore. We should have tasks. And a job will get cut down into lots of small tasks. And then you can assemble your customized role by saying, I'm going to do these 15 different things this quarter or this month, right? So OKR models allow us to do that. There are other organizational models that enable that, but we get to customize the work that we get to do in smaller packets, as we want to do it.
Yeah, and actually, on the game example you offered, Kaihan, it's not even that it's provided; it's being created real time. Right. It'll evolve in response to us, the players. I was at the Black Knights Film Festival in Tallinn in late 2022. And this is October. This is before ChatGPT came out. And I was speaking to an audience of filmmakers, technologists, the people that make the film of the film, you know, all the technical people. And they were very concerned about AI. And this is before ChatGPT came out. And I said, well, look, it's coming. Figure out how to get ahead of it. Figure out how to leverage it. And I believe, to your question, Kelly, about poets, I believe that your skills in telling stories and creating meaningful experiences with others will actually become far more important. Not because computers won't be able to do it. They will. But because we're going to want humans to be in the game. We're going to want humans to do it. Let me give you an example. We still watch Usain Bolt and say, oh, my God, isn't that amazing? But he can't run as fast as a Honda Civic.
Right.
I mean, we can't even come close to beating a Honda Civic.
Sure.
But you know what? We still pay money to sit in seats and watch humans run against each other. So I'm actually quite excited about where this is going. But the near term is going to be rather challenging.
Yeah. There's an economic argument for that too, Rob. I mean, machines can reach infinite production, which means they become commoditized. Humans, we're only a certain number of humans on Earth. So, you know, as we're able to create coins that confirm that this was created by a human, I think that we start seeing a premium on human created content.
Oh, interesting.
Versus, because the marginal cost to produce that's higher. So, you know, why? Give me your example of the bags made by the nuns in wherever, Romania or whatever.
Well, yeah, in the Dolomites. So, by the way, I think she made up that example, but it was such a beautiful made up example. So, Kelly, before COVID, I was and just early on in the path of proximity. And I was exercising this with different people in different industries around the world. And one of those people was my friend Carlotta from the luxury goods industry. And I'm telling her about proximity and closer demand, blah, blah, blah. And she said, well, now, wait a minute, Rob. In the luxury goods space, sometimes people are eager to pay for something they can't have right away. So, for instance, somebody will pay a lot of money if they know that handbag was produced by hand by a bunch of nuns in the Dolomites, and it took them 6 months to make that stupid handbag, they're going to pay a lot more money. And I said, huh, you know, that's a really interesting provocation. But you know what? And this is actually why we focus on value. Because when you think about that case, what you realize, the value the customer is getting is not really just the physical handbag.
That's
right. The value the customer's paying for is the story, the ability to be a part of that story, to share and communicate that story, that this handbag is super special, and here's why, and I had to wait for it. So proximity is not about just products and services ever closer. It's about the value we desire ever closer to the moment of actual demand.
So this is the reason... This is, I mentioned this to you, that it's not the easiest book to read. It's fascinating. And one of the reasons I'm realizing as I'm talking to you is because it's demanding that you hold two opposite ideas in your head at the same time, and maybe a third or a fourth or a fifth. And one of the things I love about improvisation is when you're improvising, you are constantly switching between your system one, system two brain. You know, you have to mm-hmm. respond right away, but you also have to listen really deeply. And so that practice is really an incredible practice. And this is also speaking of proximity. So the office that's closest to me at Second City is our head of people, Laurel Legler. So it is not uncommon for me to be reading a book. I did it this morning, walk over to her and I read a paragraph. And when I was doing this, when you guys were talking about jobs of the future and hiring of the future, and I'm talking to her about this rather complex idea of maybe you aren't hiring a full-time person. Maybe there are these tasks that you can send out to a million people and you get back, you know, 100,000 resumes and your AI is helping you get the right person to complete that task. And then they move on and maybe they come back. It feels like to our earlier discussion of, you know, the gig economy isn't the easiest thing. And it doesn't, you know, it's again, I have a son who's inside this. He wants to be an actor. So he's also, you know, running a taco joint and it's like trying just piece together enough. So not a perfect thing, but I think what you're talking about is, yeah, that exists. It's not perfect, but maybe in the future with as the technology progresses, then requiring our culture to meet the technology where it is, to make sure we have systems where everyone has enough work, has enough food, all that stuff. Is that where this is all going?
Right. I think I don't want to get like political here, but if there were a living wage, if healthcare didn't depend on your full-time employment, right, then it would make the gig economy more human. And so there are other systems that need to evolve in order to make the a good future, proximate future. And so part of the message of the book is there is the good, and we believe this can lead to a better future for humanity on many levels, but we have to be aware of the dark side and manage it towards the good.
But also recognizing that given that we can do things we never could do before, we can make that better future happen and do so in an economically effective way. Because ultimately, if it's not economically effective, it fails and everybody loses. So we really do. I'm very optimistic. I think the next couple of decades are going to be in many ways far more difficult than most people expect. But I believe we're going to manage through that. And then the not distant future will be actually far better than where we are today.
You guys familiar with that Edelman Trust thing that comes out? Yeah. So I recently got asked to be on the board at the Chicagoland Chamber of Commerce, which is very funny. I'm the only one not wearing a black suit. You immediately know the second city guy showed up. But he presented at the very first meeting I went to, he presented their trust results. And what was very interesting to me was the part of the country that was the most distrustful of technology, things like AI, was the Midwest.
Really?
Yeah.
Did Richard have an idea why that was?
Automobile industry. That they got so affected by taking technology, took away so many jobs.
So many jobs, I see.
And the proximity of other people, not even in the industry, could see these people losing their jobs, that technology equaled bad.
Interesting.
Yep. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
And because you would also think in a, you know, Midwest includes Chicago, you know, very urban centers with lots of universities where people would be like, no, I'm just like, this is what happens. But yeah.
In the book, we talk about, you know, there's, and whenever you think about technology, I think we have a gut reaction to good or bad. Right. And it leads us to imagine an utopian Jetson future or a dystopian.
Like a Terminator,
like
robotic.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And a problem is the one that you imagine informs what decisions you make, and that then influences what future we get. So I don't think it's necessarily Rob and I have a very optimistic view of the future, but I think it's important for us to be thinking also about the potentially dystopian future so that we can predict what could go wrong and we can put in place the momentum to avoid that.
I want to ask you about, you talk about the U.S. Navy SEAL team that killed Osama bin Laden, and you talked about they were a small local force. How many people were in that? Do you guys remember?
Five or six? Usually it's five, yeah.
But... Yeah. That's what I thought. So Second City's casts are always six.
Mm.
And this has been, you know, so our sample size has been going on since 1959 up to right now. We've tried with seven. We've tried with five. We've tried with four. We've tried with eight. Six is what works for us. And it is just the perfect amount to get the variety that you need, but also the, you know, familiarity that the audience has with them. I mean, do you remember when SNL started to go to those casts of like 25 and everyone's like, there are too many people?
Yeah.
You know, and so I'm curious to like, what is, you talk a bit about small teams, right? And I would imagine that makes those teams more proximate.
Yes. For example, there is an interesting company in China called Haier. They bought GE Appliances. They'd be hugely successful. They bought GE Appliances about 6 years ago. They were $15 billion in revenue. Today, they're $32 billion in revenue. What they did, if you ask them why were they so successful, because a lot of that was organic growth. What they did is they took their organization, they broke it down to 4,000 micro enterprises, each with about 10 people. Each one has a CEO. If the CEO is not doing a good job, the people who report to the CEO can vote the CEO out. And then they broke down their support functions, their people function, their finance function, their market function into different small functions. And what we start seeing is instead of trying to organize humans through a centralized hierarchy, we organize it through a combination of democracy and internal marketplaces. So we create a more fluid environment. What that allows them to do is to be in closer proximity to customers and be more responsive to customers, react more quickly to them. I mean, it does have to do with the fact that the communication cost or the coordination cost between humans is coming down because of technology. And it used to be that a hierarchy, a king, a pope was the most efficient way to organize. And now economics are changing so we can organize in smaller components. And yeah.
Well, you've probably all heard of Jeff Bezos' famous pizza rule. If we're going to get a team together, we can't have more than the people that can be served by two pizzas. And I love that, but though people misconstrue it often or misunderstand it, then if you're trying to scale a business from $100 million to $500 million, you probably can't do that with two pizzas.
That's right.
Now, unless it's fully automated, that is possible. But, you know, the right place and the right time. Am I working on a problem? Am I trying to develop a new product or concept? Am I working on a show at Second City that I need to create? You got two pizzas. But if I'm building an auto plant or a network of small scale auto plants all over the country, I probably need more than six people.
Yeah, but I think that what you talk about in the book, which is, so when I think about affecting change, like with our work or with any work, you're not going to affect societal change individual by individual. It's just not going to happen. I also don't think you can affect it institution by institution. They're just too big. I think you can affect it team by team. So you're not talking about getting rid of hierarchies. Hierarchies exist, but you're also talking about empowering teams within those hierarchies to work effectively, manage empathetically, and then coordinate with other people. And that is different than the structure that exists. I mean, who is the management theorist from Austria that everyone quotes and no one pays attention? Drucker was talking about this like years ago, and everyone talks about how smart Drucker is, yet they don't seem to employ the full scope of what he was talking about.
You're essentially pushing decision making authority further out. It's more decentralized, and a lot of those teams are right in front of the audience, right? So they're not reading a script that was written a week ago by a writing team in a room, right? They are creating right there in front of the audience. There's a lot of research that says six is kind of a magic number. Improvement in the effectiveness of a meeting goes up to six, and then with the seventh, it starts coming down. So six is sort of a perfect number.
Yeah, and I think there's that other I forget what the name of it is, but the idea that you could probably hold about six to seven ideas in your mind at the same time.
Yeah, seven plus or minus two is a short term working memory capacity of a human. Yes,
it's funny how these are all sort of the same thing.
Yeah. And you know, technology evolves more quickly than humans. So humans, we're going to take a long time to evolve. So it makes sense that the way that we work efficiently together won't change, because that's sort of ingrained in us for millennia, right? So if six is the right number, I think six stays the right number. What was interesting is we did this experiment with some chief strategy officers, and we had them work in teams of six. We had two of them become robot enabled, which is to say they could address an LLM, they could address a ChatGPT, and one of them was a pure robot. That person could not speak any of their own words, but could only type a prompt and read a prompt. And it was really interesting to see how those six interact. The big issue that we found was it takes too long for the robot to give his response. By the time he gives his response, the humans have already moved on to the next scene, if you will, right? Mm. So I think that's going to be the next challenge. And I think voice is going to help a lot with that, but increasing communication speed between them. So I don't know, maybe one of those six could start incorporating an AI into that.
The latency factor is quickly being resolved. We're going to see the extraordinary progress on that in the next couple of years. Like, you're going to not even notice it anymore. But to your point, Kelly, I love the point about teams and change and all that. But one of the things I've seen with AI proliferating in various industries is some places are getting better at recognizing AI can be a monitoring and oversight system. And yes, it could be like George Orwell, but it could also be very effective. Let's say, for instance, one of our friends builds systems for casinos, and the systems help allocate the time and attention of the people who work on the floor of the casino. And they report, I could go into the long story, but they report making more money, much happier with their job because the people on the floor, their consumers, are much happier. And they can actually work fewer hours and make the same amount of money if they want. That's sort of the deal. But what was really interesting was the AI system was tracking everybody and seeing what, where things are working, where they're not working. What does that sound like? That sounds like a supervisor.
Yeah.
So what's happening is they're not cutting out people on the floor. They're cutting out the supervisor levels. Now, if you ever wondered what the heck a supervisor was doing, well, you don't have to wonder anymore. So it's That's really supervisor thing. And so that could help manifest, Kelly, your concept of small teams out there at the coalface, interacting with the world and decreasing the number of people who sit in the corner office acting, you know, acting like they're really important, because AI can start doing that very effectively.
Yeah.
All right. So the I'm going to ask you each for a yes and story in a moment, but this all leads to you call the not too distant future post virtual, and you say that, quote, our concept of reality will need to evolve, end quote. That's kind of what we're getting to here. That's the big philosophical cultural proposition, which is all these things are happening. They're going to happen, but for them to become useful, integrated, you know, net positive, we as a people, as a culture, governmental, all of it, we need to shift our reality. I mean, that's a, I know, I believe, I agree with you. It's, but that is not going to be easy.
Well, nothing great is ever easy. Wow. But actually one of my favorite philosophers, Kelly, is Richard Rorty, the American pragmatist. And he died in 2007. So it is way before all this fake news stuff, but he said something really compelling, which was truth is what we can get away with saying. Now, it has only become more poignant, what he was articulating. And there was great depth, and it's scary as heck as well,
yeah,
in real way. But the post-virtual concept, so Moran Cerf, a neuroscientist, and I started working on that about the same time I was working on proximity. And Kaihan and I decided to integrate it into that final chapter, because post-virtual evolves out of what we today know as virtual reality. And it's one of the two horizons of the 21st century for humanity. And those are space and virtual reality, because we haven't really been to either one. Now, I mean, some of us have been to the moon, if you believe that. By the way, I do believe that. But none of us have really been to space, and we really haven't had virtual reality yet. Imagine in 10, 20, 30 years when we throw away the goggles and you have direct visceral experience of almost anything, anytime, anywhere. Both of these environments, space and virtual reality, are 100% proximate. If you're on a spaceship for 9 months to Mars, you've only got what's on the ship, so you better have it. You can't call Amazon because you forgot something. I mean, not yet, but that'll happen eventually. But so all the research going on in the world to help have humans in space is to drive toward proximity, everything. And virtual reality, as it gets better and better and better, you will be able to experience anything, anywhere, anytime. And that's both exciting and also terrifying.
Yeah, because, I mean, yeah, because there's no light in our heads. All this thing, that everything we sense gets translated into electrical signals. So the reality that we experience right now is an electrical interpretation of what we think we see, smell, hear, taste, touch. We named our daughter Maya. Her middle name's Maya because Maya is the veil that in Hinduism, they believe we are actually living in a fake reality, right? And so being enlightened is realizing this was just a game. It's a virtual reality game that we just got really into and we forgot that it was a game. So I don't know if that's true or not, but it makes sense that if we were to live in a post-virtual world, we may not know it to be any worse or different than our current reality. And young kids today, I saw this interview of Keanu Reeves. He was talking to a girl about, she's doing some kind of virtual game. And he's like, but it's not real. And she says, oh, I don't care. I don't think the next generation so much cares if it is real or not. The experience of it is real. So those things come together and,
so
anyway, I don't want to get too.
No. I hear here's where I tie it back to, which is, so we've done a lot of work with improvisation and people with social anxiety and people with Parkinson's. And we created a whole improvisation for caregivers program, primarily working with caregivers and the people they're caring to who have dementia. And the idea, the core idea of yes and improvisation, right, is that you accept, you affirm what the person is saying to you and you build upon it. And there's a bit of research coming out on this that when you're dealing with someone with dementia, blocking does not help matters. But the idea of yes and does.
And well, the idea, I'm sorry, when you say blocking, Kelly, what do you mean?
Saying no. You're like when they say, know, here, like, I want to go to France, you know, and they can't go to France. You don't say no, or they say I'm in France and say, no, you're not in France. Like, if you were to do that in an improv stage, like, you're booted off. Like, yeah. you have to yes and, because you're not going to get anywhere with no. But what if you said yes and went further? And I remember I was driving in my car. I've told the story a few times, and I'm listening to This American Life. And these two improvisers are being interviewed by Ira Glass about using that principle with their one of their moms who had dementia. And they ended up having these beautiful conversations where they went to these really interesting places and they ended back. And I'm literally the guy who wrote the book, Yes And, who didn't do that with their mom who had dementia. Wow. That is a pullover, sobbing my eyes out moment. But then led us to then work in this area. But it's just that it drives home that idea of, like, who's reality?
Yeah. Yeah,
their reality is their reality.
Yes. Yes.
So I think there's pockets in our culture that sort of understand that, interesting pockets, that maybe that move is not as gargantuan as it seems. I don't, I hope so.
That's beautiful. Yeah. If we could live like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Right. All right. So I'm going to grab from each of you a yes and story. Kaihan,
yeah,
go first.
Sure. I'm not sure when I want my son to hear this, but we had two children. Two children. We really wanted a third child, and we didn't, and we didn't, and we didn't. Then our neighbor said, "We have two children, and they're not in diapers anymore. Wouldn't it be great just to have two children?" We thought, "Yeah, maybe." Right? Yes, and is my wife ends up pregnant, and I am so happy that I cannot imagine what my life would have been without our youngest son, Makar. He just brings joy and dynamism to the entire family dynamic. That's my
I think he wouldn't mind that yes and story. I think
as long as he's here, here's the end.
Yeah, you gotta hear it. Rob, how about you?
It sounds like, Kaihan, you enjoyed that yes story quite a lot over those years. So yes. In any case, well, my yes and is a little bit different. It was catalyzed by COVID. Mm-hmm. And by the way, Kelly, you're in Chicago. I'm a lifelong Chicagoan until recently. I love Chicago, love Chicago area. Grew up there. My family and I were living in Evanston, Illinois, where I teach part-time at Kellogg, and I also teach part-time at Booth on the other side of the city. But our house was right across from campus, and we were near the lake. It was great. COVID hit. So before COVID, I traveled a lot. And I was sitting in my home office for 6 or 7 months stewing. And I went to my wife and I said, Ada, every time I go downtown Chicago, I pass my freshman dormitory. I want to move. And she said, well, okay. So I won't go to the whole story, but we decided to move to New Jersey. So doesn't everybody? I mean, wasn't
as much as
we all dream, dying to the dream that was the COVID of Newark.
Right? Let's all go to New Jersey. So, yeah. You know what? We did a lot of research online. We went in person, had to wear the masks, brought the kids. Long story short, I love it. It's been a catalyst in my life. We love the town, Ridgewood, New Jersey. It's an actual town. It has a town square with restaurants, coffee shops. I can walk the town with the dog. I hate driving. I love cars. I hate driving. It's near Newark Airport. So I travel overseas a lot, nonstop everywhere. We both have family in the region. And you know what? I was already like 52 or so at the time when we moved. It was a compelling yes and in terms of being a catalyst in this for this next phase of my life. And the kids love the schools and their friends. So big move would never have happened had it not been for the COVID crisis.
In 7 years of doing the podcast, this is the first Jersey yes and.
Well, so, you know, I got more of them if you want.
I think we leave it on the Jersey Yes And. The book is called Proximity: How Coming Breakthroughs in Just-in-Time Transform Business, Society, and Daily Life. Gentlemen, thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thank you so
much, Kelly. This was great.
Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
Adulthood, no one survives.